Welcome to the first edition of the Granite City Journal, a look at the history and people of Barre, Vermont. There are two accounts of the naming of Barre. The official version, supported by Old Town Records, gives the honor to one Ezekiel D. Wheeler, who pledged the most money to the new meeting house fund of 1793. The other version, dismissed by some as persistent legend, attributes the choice to the result of a fight. Dissatisfied with the town's original name of Wildersburg, the townspeople called a special town meeting to select another name. The meeting became an agitated contest between two Massachusetts men, Thompson from Holden and Sherman from Barre, each of whom championed the name of his own hometown. In one of his poems, Vermont rhymester Dan Cady has given us his version of this perhaps apocryphal confrontation. The poem, read here by retired Barre mailman and active amateur historian Morris Maxfield, concludes with the crowd's impatience with the resources of reason and their demand that the two Bay Staters settle things in the true frontier manner.
The crowd was getting pretty tired and soon commenced to shout, "You fellows with such loads of lip, why don't you fight it out?" Whereat they grinned and quickly agreed across the pole to fight. And if one knocked the other down, then any rules was right. So off they went to Calvin's barn to organize the game and started in to scrap for what is now a city's name. Son Thompson, with a fearful swing, laid out his rival clean, and jumping on his prostrate form, began to bat his beam. But Sherman dodged with great success, and missing not his aim, he ransacked Thompson's ribs as though he had a world to name. At last, with will and skill supreme, he rolled the Holdenite and found himself atop of one who showed no further fight. Then springing up and standing high above his foeman's frame, he shouted, "Barre, there by God, now Barre is the name."
However Barre was named, the name seems to fit, and both stories seem plausible, for the character of the granite center of the world encompasses both a streak of civic-minded gentility and an irrepressible rough and readiness, a cocky willingness to take on all comers and have fun doing it. First settled in 1788, Barre's early years were spent as a typical pioneer town, with agriculture as the main economic activity. According to Maxfield,
"The first agriculture was subsistence agriculture, see? And the cash crop was potash. They fell the trees, burn them, and leach them, and get the potash out of them. The saying is that if you could see a light at night, you had a near neighbor."
But farming was not to be Barre's destiny. Rather, that destiny resided in the granite hills surrounding the town. Before the coming of the white people, migrating Indians had used this hard, durable stone for arrowheads, harnesses, and other tools. Early settlers also found granite useful, fashioning it into millstones, doorsteps, posts, and window lintels. And by the second decade of the 19th century, two soldiers returning from the War of 1812 had opened Barre's first commercial quarry on Cobble Hill. A finer grade of granite was soon discovered on Millstone Hill, which soon became the main focus of quarrying activity. Beginning in 1832, Millstone Hill granite was transported to Montpelier by horse and ox teams over the winter snows for use in the construction of the state capitol building. But it wasn't until after the Civil War and the extension of the Central Vermont Railroad from Montpelier to Barre in 1875 that the granite industry was to come into its own. As the fame of the now easily transportable Barre granite spread, workers were attracted to the quarries and sheds from Scotland, Scandinavia, and Italy. Other immigrants came also, helping to turn Barre into a thriving commercial and industrial boomtown. Between 1880 and 1890, Barre's population, which in 1790 was 76 people, jumped from 2,060 to 6,812, and by 1894, the year in which Barre was incorporated as a city, its population had reached 10,000. But along with growth and prosperity, the granite industry brought certain hazards. The new technology, introduced beginning in the 1880s and which included polishing machines and later pneumatic drills, increased productivity, but also filled the air in the granite sheds with the fine white dust, dust that made lung diseases of silicosis and tuberculosis and death at an early age the price of working in the sheds. A former mayor of Barry told a Federal Writers Project researcher in the 1930s that sometimes the air was so full of dust you couldn't see the man next to you. In Barry's cemeteries, granite stones ironically marked many a worker's grave. By the late 1930s, however, the concern of such Barry citizens as Cornelius Granai and Dr. D.C. Jarvis resulted in the installation of suction devices that put an end to the tragically high incidence of TB and silicosis.